Thank you very much for thank you very much, Professor Hirose, for your kindest introduction. And first of all, I would like to congratulate upon this occasion. And I am feeling very well on this occasion because I happen to be engaged in various occasions in which I am certainly surrounded by bureaucrats of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and familiarizing myself with the cultures of special agencies of the United Nations and so on. And so that is, to some extent, interesting, but by nature, I'm a scholar, academics. So I'm very delighted to be engaged in this kind of combination of practical perspectives and academic contributions. So I would like to enjoy this process, and I really, really thank you, the organizer of this symposium for inviting me. And I think very delighted to make comments on two distinguished, very interesting papers, presentations by our colleagues in this afternoon. But before I make comments on the last two presentations, probably I would like to remind myself or ourselves of the title of this session. I haven't discussed the purpose of this session with the organizer and so on. So what I'm doing is simply my interpretation of the purpose of this session. But the title of this session is Emerging New Phenomena of Conflicts in the World. So we are expected to talk about emerging new phenomena of conflicts and as well as probably a peace in the world. Probably we assume that there is some kind of new phenomena in this or phenomena in this world. And in order to have a new approach, a better approach probably, for peace building or conflict prevention, first of all, we would like to identify and analyze what we understand as a new phenomenon. Otherwise, our efforts wouldn't be very constructive. That is the kind of a starting point and the purpose of this session. And I think that the first two presentations in this afternoon, Professor Cushing and Professor Tosa gave us a very interesting insights from this perspective. Especially Professor Tosa reminded us of the very simple fact that despite new issues, new phenomena, war is always war. And we shouldn't be deceived by any fashionable academic discussions and so on. We ought to be very serious about the reality. That's something which we ought to bear in mind in every single occasion, every time. But having, and I would like to remind Professor Tosa that the last time we made presentations in the same panel at the occasion of a Peace Studies Association or something like that, I presented a paper on the topic of the to compare United States involvement in Iraq to United States occupation of the southern states, a federal government. Of the occupation of the federal government in the southern states after the American Civil War. And there are many similarities and many very interesting set of minds which we can identify in these two cases. I was, at that time, criticized by senior professors for my very rough uses of the word peace building and uncritical attitude toward the United States. But the United States has been engaged in invasions, occupation in Haiti, Guatemala, Panama, the Philippines, many, many countries since 19th century. And so even when we talk about very, very recent phenomena of occupation of Iraq by the superpower, single superpower, and so on, we still get a clue in the past history to understand this new phenomenon. So war is war, is war. United States is always United States in a way. Having said that, for the in order to recognize the greatest contribution of Professor Tosa. Still, we ought to think of some new issues. It doesn't make sense to say that everything is always the same for two centuries or so. Of course, there are some new things. We want to distinguish something traditional, something that remains same, and something which are really, really new. And probably we are almost understanding or reaching the conclusion there is somehow new growing phenomenon in this world in the 21st century that did not exist probably in the 19th century or even the 20th century. And that is not the, probably the military exercise of the United States, simple use of weapons, but something rather more grand. And how to describe the phenomenon requires some kind of nuanced skill. And I'm not sure I can do it very well. But I think that our colleagues have made very good works to describe it. And what we understand as something like a liberal order, liberalism, imperialism of liberalism, something like that, that is somehow a new phenomenon in this world. Of course, United States traditionally talked about freedom, republicanism, and so on since the establishment of its own country or federal state or the independence. But we do not believe the spread of liberal values, operations based on very specific West-oriented liberal values, this phenomenon existed in the 19th century. In the 19th century, Western people talked about white man's burden. Rather, we are now talking about freedom, democratization of Iraq, and a responsibility to protect. There are some similarities, but there is a growing big difference between them. And that is something I think that, in my opinion, we academics describe as the power of liberal order in this world. Having said that, I try to be very academic and very objective, not being engaged with any value judgment. That phenomenon has a good point and a bad point. But first of all, we want to identify this phenomenon and analyze it very carefully. Commenting on the Professor Cushing's presentation, I really, really agree with his comment. But probably if we take sides with the ideological standpoint of President Bush, probably they have, President Bush government, his team, has a theory of root causes of conflict. They believe there are some conflicts in this world because of something. Why? Because of the existence of undemocratic states. So until we democratize, ultimately, in theoretically speaking, in theory, until we democratize every state, we will continue to have problems. But when we democratize all the states, I think that there will be a point in which, at which we shall enjoy democratic peace and sustainable peace in the world. That is a theory, very contested theory, but that is a theory in which many people actually believe, surprisingly or not, actually believe. And very, very surprisingly, people like President Bush has expressed the theory without leaving any doubts about that. And that is very surprising. Sometimes we Japanese do not believe how frank he is. I think that I don't think he is so serious about this theory because that doesn't sound like very serious. But they seem to be very serious about this theory. And they are motivating and promoting very significant phenomena in this world, which I described as the spread and growing power of liberalism throughout the world. This phenomenon is not taking place by accident. There are some historical conditions in which people can now Therefore, with these conditions, now people can talk about this kind of power of liberalism. In the very, very long-term historical perspective, I would like to illustrate some incidents in the history of humankind in the context of peace building or peace operations, conflict, war. It's a matter of fact. Now we've got more states, many states, like 200 states. And this condition apparently did not exist in the 19th century, for instance. And we live in the world after the process of decolonization. When we speak of the, well, fragile states, yeah, the very problematic status of nation states, we usually refer to not, we do not refer to Great Britain, for instance, or France. We usually refer to newly independent states, which were born as a result of decolonization that took place only in the latter half of the 20th century. In the history of humankind, that's a very, very new incident. And now we are still struggling with the remaining impact of this very big event of decolonization. That was such a big event. So we have to struggle with the aftermath of this event for a century, at least for decades. And but with the end of the Cold War, we had to. We have to take into consideration of the condition of the post-Cold War world. And now I think that we have to take into consideration the conditions created by the advent of the War on Terror. And these are the conditions which we need to take into consideration in order to understand the newly growing phenomenon of power of liberalism, decolonization that created, that led to the so many, many nation states in the world, and the Cold War, the end of the Cold War, that led to the some kind of unity, possibility of a uniting world community, and the War on Terror. With this event, we can talk about spread of liberalism by missiles, by military exercises. That sounds paradoxical for most Japanese, but that is certainly a true part of a very, very simple fact in this world. So having said that, these somehow discuss the conditions in which we can identify the new condition, new phenomenon of in the world concerning peace and conflicts. I would like to make comments on two presentations. Professor Norman Cook very, very beautifully described the state of international cooperation or developmental aid. I think that from the actual his own actual experiences on the ground. And I really appreciate it. And I do not have any reservations or concerns or problems with his comment. But, of course, his conclusion was somehow open to further considerations. He talked about degradation of nation states and needs to redo international system and so on. But then the question is, how can we do it or should we do it if we should do it? Should do something in that context. And I fully agree with the very weak status of nation states, but I analyze this simply because of the fact of the process of decolonization and the spread of Western values throughout the world. So talking about weakening weak power of some nations, or maybe a majority of states, does not mean that the value system that enables us, that requires us to talk about nation state, is declining. No, we have to stick to the system of nation states, although no matter how weak it's becoming. So what we do is when we are engaged in international cooperation or development aid, which is very, very new event, international cooperation, development aid, did not exist in the 19th century. That took its current shape, at least in the latter half of the 20th century, in coincidence, in accordance with the process of decolonization, the spread of nation states. So in the sphere of development aid, we need to take into consideration these factors. Very clear limit on the role or the power of nation states, but we need to understand that we cannot abandon nation states. So what we do is, in my opinion, is to recognize the nature of developmental aid in this world. What is the nature of development aid? Well, of course, there are many, many aspects which we need to examine for further development of improvement of development aid. But as a scholar doing research on peace building, and as a person who is interested in the linkage between development aid and peace building, what I would like to raise is the issue of politics in developmental aid. We recognize the limit of the role of nation states, but we have to admit that we cannot abandon nation states. We know that the government of Sudan is not a perfect, beautiful state, but we still feel a need to discuss what kind of state they can have in the territory called Sudan. And the problematic status of Sudan, the state called Sudan, is not new. It's a result of the independence of the state called Sudan. Our perspective, what we are require, is the perspective to which, with which we can give meaning to developmental aid for political purposes. Why? Because peace is very political. If we want to mobilize developmental aid for peace, we need to politicize developmental aid. Unfortunately, that is a process we need to inevitably recognize, and I think that with these conditions, what we do is to politicization of healthy politicization and a political examination of developmental aid. And I would like to make comments on the Professor Safi's presentation as well. I really, really enjoyed his presentation, and again, I fully agree with his observation of various things, including many divisions, state of divisions in this world. And what is striking is that he emotionally discusses the history of the state of Afghanistan. Although we know that the history of the state of Afghanistan is not so happy story, but still we find it necessary to discuss the state of Afghanistan. And he reminded me and us of the simple fact that there are many people, and there have been many people who struggled with the topic of revitalizing the state called Afghanistan. And he raised the issue of United Nations for the sake of world peace, and which I really appreciate. My question is that in the context of my previous remarks, people tend to describe Afghanistan from his own way. Well, it's a state, a post-conflict state. It's still its capacity is still limited, but we recognize it very important, and we want to create a special sector on Afghanistan because it's so important. Why? Because of the war on terror. But these interpretations, these exercises of giving the meaning to Afghanistan, is being done by international actors. We really, really need the contribution from Afghan people themselves. What kind of meaning should we recognize in the state of Afghanistan if we take side with the perspective of Afghan people, not with the United States? And if there is some kind of role for Afghanistan, that's not an omnipotent role, which we discussed. and probably the role is limited, but still we want to identify some kind of role of Afghanistan. And now again, I'm not asking about the role of Afghanistan for the war on terror. That is very relevant, but war on terror is the word given by some international actors. We know that the Taliban issue, religious propaganda, all these are quite crucial issues in Afghanistan. But we want to reinterpret these issues from the perspective of Afghanistan. And we want to clearly recognize the role of the state of Afghanistan on from the perspective of Afghan people. And that's something which I want to ask to Professor Safi. Thank you very much.
篠田先生どうもありがとうございました。篠田先生。
Thank you very much, Dr. Shinoda. And he asked questions to Dr. Cushing and Dr. Tosa as well. Maybe those can be discussed in the Q&A to follow. But now we'd like to ask Dr. Cook and Dr. Safi to each take 5 minutes to comment on the comments by Dr. Shinoda. Dr. Cook, please.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shinoda. I hope that I wasn't misunderstood in suggesting that the modern nation state is at a very end. I guess what I was suggesting is that we're really into a very important reordering that's been brought on by our desires to be more effective in some important way as nation states, issues in harmonization, issues in coordination of policy, at some level have begun to force national policy planners to abandon their fiat in favor of those mandates and those fiats that they share in common with, I think, others with whom they're coordinating. So there's that dynamic. There's also the dynamic, of course, of the working of corporations, the emergence of the multinational as a force that begins to recuperate or, if you will, expropriate some of the regulatory power within the individual nation state. And by the way, I would suggest in my view that that's not only about Western. That's, and certainly sitting here in Japan, a non-Western society that contributes very highly to that process, I would dare say that we need to think of it as global rather than Western specific. And that might be for us perhaps more helpful in going deeper into the problem. But I think that what I'm really getting at when I talk about the nation state here is I'm really focused on citizenship. I'm focused on the way in which citizens globally seem to be redefining themselves, be they the poor dispossessed fighting for resources in a Darfur or some ill-forgotten African country, or be they people living in the center of Tokyo. I think that in some important way, they're beginning to understand that they share more and more common insecurity. That insecurity really does require the opening up of common security spaces. And what's more, those are global. Those are global and regional. And they're beginning to speak to each other about those kinds of things. And I think a very good example of that is the gay movement. You know, I was struck at the decisions that were taken at the World Council of Racism in South Africa by and Durban by a number of people who were in fact involved in that gay community and its drive. You had them from all over the world talking to each other, talking about common security space. So that's part of the, and I'm just not referring to the gay community, I could be referring to the women's community, I could be referring to any one of a number of communities that in fact has began to globalize. In some important way, even as we begin to talk about the framework of conflict, we have to understand that we're now in a world of extremely value-added conflict in which the interconnectivity between players, be they Yakuza or Mafia or various kinds of financiers of these conflicts, these lines are becoming more and more extended, and in fact they're connected to each other. Profoundly connected to each other, and they're sharing a common space that's setting up our common insecurity. And more, I think, people are beginning to understand it's important to work jurisdictionally to try to control that insecurity and create common security space. In fact, the framework of human security, as we're beginning to understand it, begins to partly address in the governance area that question of common security space. The other thing I'd like to say, maybe as a final statement, is about the politicization of aid. I think that I agree that aid needs to, or peace building needs to be politicized, but I would also suggest that it's already profoundly politicized. And it's mainly politicized these days through governance programs of the major donors. What concerns me is where that all gets focused. It tends to get focused within two processes, one of which is elections. Somewhere there's the belief that if people have elections, you have democracy. So let's pour a lot of money into elections, most of which, I should say, is added to the budgets of international observers, right? Which is another issue altogether. The other one is for constituency support, for the support for existing political parties, usually those favored by the donors, and their constituencies. And by the way, if anybody doesn't believe that those twin processes can be disastrous in governance programs, just look at the slow car wreck that is Kenya today. And you'll see that the donors in doing governance programs failed those citizens of Kenya in some very important ways. My final statement I'd like to make is about democracy. In the insistence that democracy is good and everybody should eat it, there's a vision of democracy. And that division of democracy has the notion of rights at the very center of it, rights. And the rights that are spoken about are individual rights. Everyone believes, who's a promoter of democracy, that it's very important to have democracy in which individuals have rights. I also agree with that. But there's another important reality, and that's that the groups that are in conflict are fighting for collective rights. And they're the collective rights of the dispossessed. And the notion of collective rights must be embraced in our new vision of democracy going forward into peace building and conflict prevention, because that's the core issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cook. Then, please, Dr. Safi, could please proceed.
So, thank you very much, Professor Shinoda, for your comments, kind comments, and about the question of the role of the state of Afghanistan from the perspectives of the Afghans. So we must talk about the present regime, you mean. If I tell you the fact that we don't have a state in Afghanistan yet, in what we know as a government in the world, in the real legal and political context, we don't have it yet. It means if an administration cannot decide its policy internally and externally, if an administration cannot reach all its individuals, population inside the country to control it, if an administration cannot reach all its provinces inside the country, in its territory, and cannot control the territory of itself, there is no state from my point of view. No state exists. From the international point of view, the international subject of international law is not going to be applied now in Afghanistan, because the international forces or exist there, they can operate themselves without the permission of the central government. They can go and search for the houses of our population against their culture. They can create every inhuman activity and kill our civilians. So still we can ask, what is the role of Afghan state? Which state? I say it not only here. I say it inside Kabul. I say it to my media, I say it to international media, and I say it now also. that please, international community must pay attention to create and establish an Afghan state. Then we will talk about its role. And unfortunately, its own people cannot establish it, because I don't go so far as when British India and the Tsarist Russia was making Afghanistan as their buffer. And also, I don't go so far that until 1973 coup d'etat, it was the absolute kingdom. And they didn't have a university. They didn't have education. They didn't have enough schools for the population. The kingdom in the international community was not asking that regime. They didn't want, if they were thinking, if the population is going to be educated, their desires will be high, and then it will weaken the kingdom. So that's why they killed our leaders. And when the leftists came after the coup d'etat, they killed all the national leaders. When the rightists come after the communist coup d'etat and succeeded the so-called state in power, they killed all those who were living in the time of the communists. So who will create a state there? And just now also, this government has been brought by international conference decision in Bonn, after Bonn conference. So it is a kind of the reconciliation government consists of all drug lords, warlords, at the top, Mr. Karzai. So how they can voice for being an independent state? Unfortunately, I don't see any role for it. If we don't change it, if we don't really establish a good state to have the support of its population behind it, I don't see any role there. Because all, can we say a government or a state or government, that it comes to power after a conference and takes its salary from the United Nations? Or from the other countries' donations, they give the salary for the president until the guard of the street. This is not a state. Unfortunately, I like your question, and I am also searching for that what will be the role of the future Afghan state and government. Thank you very much.
Safi-sensei, arigatou gozaimasu.
Professor Safi, thank you very much. Professor Shinoda has some comments.
I would like to your vision of the role of the government, because now the international community is trying to get the role of the Afghan state, what they understand as the Afghan state, from Afghanistan, because they want to get the role from Afghanistan according to their own vision. And as long as this situation continues, you cannot possess your own role of state of Afghanistan. So in order to get your own state of Afghanistan, I think that my question is that you need to have a role, sense of the role, a vision of the role of Afghanistan.
Okay, that vision will exist. Now the international community, after the London Compact especially, and as you know, in the Camp David talk with President Bush, they have asked him to bring a change in the administration. But if you have followed our news, our president 10 days before had a speech, and in his speech he cried for international community and showed his weakness that he cannot bring the change in his government. If a president cannot bring change in his ministries, in executive power, and needs the international support and help to appoint new leaders for him, new ministers for him, according to his proposals, what vision can I have now to this government? But for the future, of course, we want our own government. We want a government who must be consisting of not smugglers of heroin, who must not be warlords. They must be really the representatives of the Afghan people. They must serve to the Afghan people because the Afghan, they were these illiterate Afghan people who sacrificed for their independence. 2 million martyred, but they are uneducated. They got the independence and now gave it to the intellectuals. And intellectuals were selling this country to diet and diet, and now also they are selling it to those in diet. This is the problem. My vision is, especially as an Afghan, purely intellectual, not Zionistic nationalist, but to be everyone as a patriotic for his nation, is this, that education is very important to that sense. The international community must help us to have a war against uneducation and bring the percentage of the education high in Afghanistan. We have more than 90% population cannot read and write. In this 21st century, this is a shame for a country. That's why we have to strive to establish a government to serve the nation, to serve to its sovereignty, to serve to defend its independence internally and externally, and then to serve the nation to become to the level of the international community, at least to join the caravan of the civilization. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to all the speakers and the participants. We will have another break, but before the break, we would like to introduce the Global Campus Program Project. Professor Imai will introduce this Global Campus Program. So I will talk about Global Campus Program. This is subsidized by the Ministry of Education. This is a 3 years program. What you are seeing on the slide shows the member schools from Afghanistan, Cambodia, Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Japan. Universities are engaged in a common lecture using a TV conference systems. We have a thesis contest. We have joint researches by the faculty. This started from October through November last year. Each of the universities tried to discuss about peace, conflict, or peace building. What might be the new approaches to peace building? There were lectures held at different universities, and at the University of Japan, this is the scene. About the specifics of the Global Campus Program, please find information in the brochure or access the website. Thank you very much. So please access the website. So we will have a 15-minute break. So please come back after the break. Thank you.